from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I'm sitting in today for Tony. I'm Jody Heiss, the Senior Vice President here at FRC. Tony is traveling, and it's my joy to have you on board with us as this next hour is going to be bringing you highlights of the current news from a biblical perspective. Let's begin with this, some of the highlights. The UN Security Council, they held a closed-door emergency session this afternoon following an Israeli airstrike Sunday that led to civilian deaths in Gaza. All of this comes just days after the UN's top court has ordered Israel to immediately stop its efforts in the southern Gaza city of Rafah.
Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate, which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
That was Judge Nawaf Salam, who is the president of the International Court of Justice, last Friday in issuing the order in the case South Africa v. Israel. So how should the United States support our ally, Israel, even as the international community continues to show more support for Hamas terrorists than they do for Israel? Well, Texas Congressman Nathaniel Moran, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, will be joining me here in just a few moments to discuss that. And a shocking report from the Wall Street Journal yesterday, it quotes officials from European allies claiming that the Biden administration has pressured them to back off of plans to censure Iran from advancing its nuclear program. Well, not surprisingly, the Biden administration is denying these reports.
That report is not true. We have not lobbied any country to vote against or abstain from any resolution in that regard. We are actively increasing pressure on Iran through a combination of sanctions, deterrence, and international isolation to counter their destabilizing behavior and prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Well, that was State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller earlier today responding to the claims. So can we really believe what he said? And how might such an action by the Biden administration and the State Department in particular, how does that further embolden a nuclear Iran? Well, retired Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis, Senior Fellow for National Security here at FRC, will explain that a little bit later. And what is a political party without a political party platform? Well, that's the question that many are asking as the 2024 Republican National Convention approaches. And how can we ensure that the 2024 GOP platform includes a strong stand for the sanctity of human life? FRC's Kana Gonzalez and I will talk more about that a little bit later in the program as well. And the 77th World Health Assembly kicked off yesterday in Switzerland. We've been talking about this for weeks. And at the top of the mind for many is the fate of the proposed pandemic treaty, which unelected bureaucrats at the international level have been trying to advance to give more power to the World Health Organization.
The pandemic agreement is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to ensure the global health system can respond more quickly and equitably when the next pandemic strikes. I urge you to bring it to fruition and to support amendments to the international health regulations, boosting our ability to respond to emergencies.
As I said, we've been talking about this for a long time. It's a critical meeting. That, by the way, was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres yesterday in a video message to the Assembly. Well, our very own Washington Stand policy editor, Travis Weber, is on the ground in Geneva, and he'll report what he's observing as the efforts continue to block the WHO's proposed pandemic treaty. So we've got a lot coming your way in the next hour. Our website, of course, is tonyperkins.com. There are tons of resources there available for you. If you happen to miss any portion of today's program or you want to catch some archive programs, it's all there, plus a lot of other info, so be sure to check it out. Again, that's tonyperkins.com. All right, as I mentioned, The UN Security Council met behind closed doors for an emergency session this afternoon. The meeting was held to discuss Israel's war against Hamas and its Sunday night airstrike in Gaza that unfortunately included some civilian deaths. But now keep in mind, these meetings are taking place after almost every major Israeli military action in Gaza has already taken place. So today's session, frankly, appears unlikely to produce any notable response from the council. But does this all aid and give fuel to the growing movement that is trying to prevent Israel from finishing the job to eliminate Hamas? Well, joining me now to discuss this and more is Congressman Nathaniel Moran. He serves on three House committees, including the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Committee on Education and Workforce. He represents the 1st Congressional District of Texas. Congressman Moran, welcome back to Washington Watch. Great to have you.
Hi, Jody. Great to be with you again today.
Well, let me begin, Congressman, first of all, just by saying we all are watching the severe storms and the outbreak across Texas over the weekend. And even today, places all across Texas are being pounded. And I just want you to personally know that we, many, are praying for you. We here at FRC are, and for the great people of Texas. And Godspeed to you, your family, and everyone in harm's way today.
Thank you, Jody. I appreciate the prayers, and the folks in Texas do as well. I was with an emergency response team on Saturday morning after one of the first flurries of storms came through. And we've got extraordinary first responders that are doing what they can, and our governor's doing what he can as well. But these are certainly tragic days for a lot of families.
They really are. Well, listen, I know you're probably busy with a lot of that, so thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. Let's jump into this whole Security Council issue. Reports indicate that several members of various nations of the Security Council, they're pushing the council to enforce the recent International Court of Justice ruling regarding Israeli operations in Rafah. What in the world could this entail, if anything, for that matter?
Yeah, it's shameful that the United Nations would take this stand, that the International Court of Justice would try to put forward their belief as to what a sovereign nation should do in defense of a terrorist attack. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about trying to substitute the UN's judgment for the judgment of Israel on how they should defend their boundaries and how they should defend their people. And that's simply shameful and unacceptable. We should not be encouraging that at all. We should be standing with Israel. And especially in this moment when we know that the four strongest battalions left in Hamas are there, they're ready to engage, and we need to finish the job. We need to allow Israel to finish the job that they started and to cut these terrorists out of that region of the world.
Yeah, it really just seems to me, it's more than just seems to me, it appears apparent that while Israel is waging a war to defeat Hamas, these international leaders are literally making excuses for terrorists. Is that your perspective in this?
Certainly, that is my perspective. And it shouldn't be really a surprise to anybody that's been watching the United Nations throughout. When we see what UNRWA and their connections were to Hamas and the terrorist attacks on October the 7th, they had people that were actually embedded with Hamas that were part of UNRWA, the relief organization through the United Nations that's supposed to be the civilian relief for instances like this. They have tons of Hamas sympathizers that are part of that organization. That's why we're trying to cut out funding for UNRWA. That's why, frankly, there needs to be a total dissection from the United Nations of that organization and say, we need to start again. And frankly, we need to ensure that the sovereignty of the nations of democratic nations around the world, like the United States and Israel, are not undercut by international organizations like the United Nations that are trying to displace our sovereign decisions.
Great point, because we likewise have been following that with UNRWA. You know, and then you have another layer. For example, today you have nations like Ireland, Norway, Spain. They formally recognized a Palestinian state, a state that does not exist and yet they formally recognize it. What kind of message does this send to Hamas and to other terrorist organizations? How are these terrorists emboldened with a message like this?
Well, that's the word I wanted to use, is emboldened. It actually supports their mission. When you look at a group of individuals and say to them, okay, yeah, you're terrorists and you have behaved in a way that is unbecoming of any morality in this world, but, oh, we're going to recognize your group of individuals with statehood when there is no state. And that's what's surprising to me. I know this is a trend among the Europeans right now, but I would suggest this is totally an erroneous road to go down, because there is no state of Palestine, and we cannot simply recognize a state that does not exist. When you simply ask questions like, well, who's in charge? Well, those questions can't be answered. Is it Hamas? Is it the Palestinian Authority? Is it the PLO? Who is it that's in charge there of this state that has been so-called recognized in existence? It simply is a road that we should not go down. Maybe we do need to have a discussion about a two-state solution. Now, I don't think it's that time to do that. I think we need to get through with vetting out these terrorists and eradicating the Hamas terrorists in the region. And then we can have some discussions about how to make the region stable long-term. But right now, the goal is eradicate the terrorists. But without having those discussions, how can you simply say, well, we're going to recognize a state when, as you say, Jody, it doesn't exist?
Yeah, there's no leaders, there's no geographic location, there's no laws. I mean, it says it totally does not exist, and yet they're recognizing it. It just seems so upside down, and it ultimately just applies pressure to Israel. If I can, real quickly, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I want to switch gears. There were some reports yesterday that were saying the Biden administration has pressed some of our allies not to confront Iran for further increasing its stockpile of uranium that apparently they have enriched to near weapon grade levels. Of course, the Biden administration is denying this, but you serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Your reaction to all this?
The one red line that we can never let Iran cross is becoming a nuclear capable country. We cannot allow them to get nuclear weapons. I think this is, again, a misjudgment by the international community to try to, and by the Biden administration, to not apply pressure where pressure is needed. We need to be strategic with the way we handle Iran. We need to increase our sanctions. But frankly, it might be the time for some very targeted, very precise military action to ensure that Iran does not become capable of a nuclear weapon. I understand that they've increased it by nearly 20 kilograms with enriched uranium here just in the last few months. Could have up to the potential of maybe 3 nuclear weapons. If that were the case, can you imagine if it's not Israel, who's their other target? It's the United States. That's who they're going to target. We cannot allow them to become.
Great point.
We cannot allow them to become a nuclear power.
Representative Moran, thank you so much. And by the way, thank you for voting no on the U.S. Financing for Iran Act. We appreciate that. Congressman Nathaniel Moran, blessings to you and the great folks of Texas. All right, after the break, we're going to continue this discussion on Iran with Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after the break.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Good afternoon. Glad to have you joining us today on Washington Watch. I'm your host, Jody Heiss, sitting in today for Tony, and thank you for joining us. All right, according to a Wall Street Journal report yesterday, the Biden administration has pushed European allies to back off plans to censure Iran for their advancement in their nuclear program. Now, officials involved in the discussions reportedly claim that this rebuke was planned for the upcoming member state board member meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency that is going to be coming up in June. And not surprisingly, as we've already reported, the Biden State Department is denying the report. But here's what State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters earlier this afternoon in that regard.
That report is not true. We have not lobbied any country to vote against or abstain from any resolution in that regard. We are actively increasing pressure on Iran through a combination of sanctions, deterrence, and international isolation to counter their destabilizing behavior and prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
All right, so some are saying you're trying to make nations back off of Iran, and you're saying, oh, no, we're not. Back and forth, here we go. So what are we to make all of this? Well, joining me now to discuss this is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. He's a senior fellow for national security here at FRC and the author of Kings of the East, China's Plans to Eliminate America and Impose a Communist World Order. Lieutenant Colonel McGinnis, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you, sir.
It's my pleasure, Jody.
All right, before I get your reaction to the State Department's rebuttal, let me just get your overall thoughts of the Wall Street Journal report.
The Wall Street Journal tends to have very good sources, Jody, so I would be more inclined to believe them than a public spokesman at the State Department. And keep in mind, and diplomacy works a number of ways. Some of it is upfront. Most of it, however, is behind the scenes, and we never acknowledge who we spoke to, much less the messages. So, you know, hearing the spokesperson of the State Department say what they said does not surprise me, just because of how much of what government does is done in the secret.
Yeah, that was exactly my first reaction, was the at least from what I know of it in personal experience, the Wall Street Journal has pretty good sources when they make a claim, and I was glad you commented on that. But despite all of it, as you mentioned, the State Department is denying it all. But doesn't the report from the Wall Street Journal really kind of fit a pattern a pattern of yielding, we might say, to Iran from the Biden administration, frankly, going back to the Obama administration. But there's a pattern, it seems to me, of yielding.
Well, there's a consistent pattern over the years, especially with JCPOA, which is the nuclear deal that the Obama, White House put together. And it was a direct compromise that gave the Iranians a great deal of money. And of course, when Biden came into office, they lifted most of the sanctions that were put in place by President Trump. And as a direct result, it enriched the Iranians to the point that not only were they able to fund Hamas and Hezbollah and other ingrates around the world, but they, of course, have poured a lot of money into their military and their Quds forces that are continuing this sort of, effort. Now, my concern, though, is that it's more broad in its scope. There's a reality that we must face, and that is the Iranians have continued their nuclear program. And their nuclear program is incredibly dangerous. You know, we heard, almost a decade ago from Prime Minister then Netanyahu from Israel, who, just unveiled a trove of secret documents that they had confiscated from a warehouse outside of Tehran. And as a result, it demonstrated conclusively that they were on a path to a nuclear weapon. And of course, here recently, and now that International Atomic Energy Agency, the kind of the watchdog for the United Nations, they're going to have a hearing next week. And that hearing is going to reconsider where they are vis-a-vis Iran and the nuclear program. And I think that that's the juxtaposed issue that the Biden administration is very nervous about. In other words, it appears as if the Iranians are accelerating their effort. And that should scare us all, primarily because of what happened on the 13th of April this year, when Iran not only used its proxies, but used ballistic missiles fired from its own territory at Israel. And that, of course, has really radically changed the climate in the Middle East.
Yeah, good point. And, I think you mentioned it, but just by way of kind of shaking the cobwebs off all of our memories, it was $10 billion that the Biden administration waived the sanctions that were frozen in Iran. I think that was November of last year. But, there is a pattern going on here. And all of this it comes even while Iran expands, as we say, all these the stockpile of near weapons grade material to record levels. I mean, they've got it to the point they've never had before. So my question to you is, why does the Biden administration refuse to draw the line on Iran?
Well, they seem to be compromised to a certain degree. The secret meetings they had last month in Oman with the Iranians was to try to get the Iranians to back off on their attacks against Israel using their proxies. And much the same with the Houthis, as well as the Iraqi Hezbollah in northern Iraq and Syria. So there's a lot that's going on here. At the same time, though, Jody, we have to acknowledge that the Iranians have kept secret some facilities that the IAEA is trying to get access to. And that's the whole cusp of what we're talking about here. And the fact that there has been a 15% increase in the total of 60% enriched uranium in their stockhold in just the last several months. And that just sends shivers up the spines of those of us that understand that Iran not only has the ballistic missiles, but also has the technology to make a bomb. And so they could, at a very slight decision from the Ayatollah, move forward rapidly to have a bomb that could be used against Israel.
Frightening, frightening information. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. Always great to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody.
All right, friends, coming up after the break, as the Republican National Convention approaches in just a few short weeks, the time is now to discuss the Republican Party platform and messaging that must be included in all of that. But there's a lot of rumors floating around about it. I'll discuss it all when we return, so stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Glad to have you joining us today. I'm your host, Jody Heiss, a senior vice president here at FRC. An honor to be sitting in today for Tony. And again, glad to have you. All right. Last week, some of you saw Tony spoke at the Muskegon County GOP Lincoln Day dinner in Michigan last week, where he shared the history of the Republican Party and discussed why the GOP has always stood for human dignity and life in the party platform. Well, with the 2024 Republican National Convention approaching this July, there are rumors of an organized campaign to weaken or to perhaps even remove altogether language from the GOP platform that insists that every boy or girl in the womb has a right to life. I don't need to tell you the tragedy that this would be. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Kana Gonzalez. He's a senior director of government affairs at the Family Research Council. Kana, welcome back to the program. Always great to have you.
Good to be here with you, Jody.
All right. So there are some rumors, and I underscored some rumors, but address what you're hearing.
Yeah, there are rumors and reports that there may be an organized effort to remove the life plank from the Republican Party platform. And look, part of this is perennial. Every cycle, every 4 years, the parties gather and write their platforms. They update the language. And since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, since 1976, the Republican Party has had something to say about the protection of the unborn every 4 years. And that language has generally gotten stronger. As a matter of fact, the last time that the language on life was updated in 2016, it was very strong, Jody. And so we would look for a continued refinement of that language, but certainly a strengthening of that language. It's interesting to look back to 1976, because then the Democrat and Republican platforms on life did not differ that much. But, of course, there's been a huge divergence over the years, and it's been increasingly vital that at least one of the two major political parties say something very, very clear about the sanctity and dignity of every human life.
All right. So this is partly—let me just pick up some of what you said there. There are debates over the party platform every election cycle. Okay, so part of what we're experiencing now, at least some of the rumors— probably is just nothing more than that. But the platform of a party is nonetheless extremely important. This is not something to just be brushed under the rug somehow, swept under the rug. What the party believes is an important aspect to every candidate who's running. It's important for the grassroots out there. It's important for things like comparing what we believe versus what they believe. So when you're talking about some of this happens every election cycle, let's talk about why overall this is an important issue, and specifically the issue of life.
Oh, yeah. I don't mean to minimize that at all. It's actually sad to me that the Democrat Party has, over the years, drifted away from protecting the unborn, and as a matter of fact, for many, many years, has gone from compromising on that issue to directly attacking the unborn. I can remember, I'm old enough to remember, and so are you, when the Democrats did not, when they had room in their party for pro-life Democrats. But the party platform is quite clear. And so, yes, it is absolutely vital that Republicans draw a sharp distinction here and show that they are and continue to be the party of life.
Well, absolutely. And other things. Obviously, there's a whole lot of issues that are brought forth in a party platform. But this issue of life, the speech, I encourage people to go back and see the speech that Tony gave last week. It was powerful. Personally, I've never seen anything like it that goes back and gives the history of the GOP on this issue as clearly as what he did. But if a party does not have a platform declaring what they believe and what they embrace in principle and values and otherwise, politically and otherwise, are they even really a party?
You know, it's a good question, Jody. What would people be voting for? Perhaps they vote for the candidate at the top of the ticket. Perhaps they vote for their local congressman or congresswoman. But really, the reason why people run for office as a Republican or run as a Democrat is best spelled out by the party platform. And I don't want to paint all doom and gloom, Jody. I don't want to make this sound like it's a foregone conclusion. We are hearing, as you said, very concerning reports. But there is still time for our listeners and viewers to weigh in. And we've built a way for people to do that. A lot of the contests that we see right now going on over the language in the party platform is over who will be voting over what language goes into the party platform. Those are special delegates. Roughly upwards of 5,000 delegates will be gathered at the Republican National Convention this summer, but only about 112 of those will be voting on the language in the party platform. And right now, those delegates are being selected at the state level. Every state has a different process, but every state has a party chairman or a party chairwoman who is instrumental in that process. You can text LIFE to 67742 or go to frcaction.org/life and weigh in with your state party chairman and ask them to protect life in the Republican National Party platform.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Kana Gonzalez, Senior Director of Government Affairs at FRC. Again, go where he just suggested that we go. frcaction.org/life or life to 67742 and help us in that regard. All right, coming up, Travis Weber is going to be joining me from Geneva, Switzerland, on an update on the World Health Assembly. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Stopping the WHO's global power grab. On the ground in Geneva.
Well, welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Jody Heiss, sitting in today for Tony, who's traveling. Glad to tell you that we are, FRC, we are on the ground for the week-long World Health Assembly that's underway in Geneva, Switzerland. Officially got kicked off yesterday, and as we're hearing, as of this point, the headlines so far mostly have covered the failure of the World Health Organization to build consensus for its proposed pandemic treaty.
We all wish that we had been able to reach a consensus on the agreement in time for this health assembly and cross the finish line. But I remain confident that you still will, because where there is a will, there is a way.
All right, well, that was WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, who's giving his opening remarks yesterday. But there appears to have been enough disagreement among some countries about the text of the agreement that it's almost certainly going to be postponed. The question is for how long and what can we do about it? And given these developments, what should we be watching for during this coming week? Well, joining me now from Geneva, FRC's own policy editor for the Washington Stand, Travis Weber. He's also vice president for policy and government affairs at FRC. He'll actually be on the program daily this week with updates from the World Health Assembly and also providing some regular updates at the Washington Stand. So for your benefit, if you'd like some additional reports and photos and other media that Travis will be able to provide this week, you can catch it all by going to frcaction.org/WHO, or you can simply text the word WHO to 67742. All right, Travis, great to see you. Thanks for staying up late.
Thank you. Thank you, Jody. Good to be with you on the program.
Well, listen, let's just begin an overall glimpse of what you've seen so far, particularly regarding the pandemic treaty. What's it looking like?
Yeah, so that is the big topic of focus this week. And the World Health Assembly meets annually to conduct the business of the World Health Organization. And oftentimes the proceedings are administrative, do not get a lot of attention. And so, you know, there's a shift this year towards the pandemic preparedness agreement that a lot of people are tracking, a lot of people are monitoring, and there's a lot of interest in, alongside of the amendments to the international health regulations, which have been around several decades, but are now under consideration for amendment after the COVID-19 pandemic. And so those two areas of policy are the two areas of focus. However, you know, there's a lot more that's happening at the World Health Assembly concerning the business of this global institution. And so, you know, we'll want to update folks on everything going on. But certainly, if we're looking at the status of the pandemic agreement right now, there was not a consensus reached, or there was not an agreement reached on the agreement. There was not agreement reached on the text before the start of this World Health Assembly. And so they do not have a common text to operate from at this point. And so the member states of the WHO are considering how to proceed in light of that. That's still yet to be determined. And there's some discussion here the last couple of days in some of the committee meetings about how to proceed. And so it's likely we could see some sort of determination from the WHO that member states agree to, or it's put to a vote about how to proceed with future consideration of the pandemic agreement. In addition, the international health regulations are under consideration here as well, and we might see some amendments that are moved ahead and considered by the full World Health Assembly towards the end of this week. And so these two areas, there's a lot yet to be done, to be determined. So far, there's not yet been agreement reached for several reasons. Primarily, the inability of nations of the world to agree on how to share their resources and how to share their the development of vaccines, intellectual property, and the resources that each nation develops, how willing they are to hand that over to the World Health Organization or distribute it globally. And so these are still items that are yet to be determined. A lot more happening this week, and folks can go to that Washington Stand page. That's washingtonstand.com/WHO for more information.
Well, it sounds like obviously there's a lot going on and a lot at stake on so many fronts. It's amazing that they're really getting started on the wrong foot without even having the capacity to get a consensus. It seems to me, and I'm sure it's much more complicated than my simple mind comprehends, but it seems to me that these are issues that should have been resolved before the assembly ever even got together. But nonetheless, in his opening remarks yesterday, the WHO Director General continued to blame misinformation as a major obstacle. I want to play a brief clip here for you, Travis, and then get your comments as to what is he referring to with misinformation. Play clip three, please.
I ask you to chart a path forward for the pandemic agreement and the IHR amendments so we can bring both to a conclusion as soon as possible. I ask all of you, governments, partners, civil society, youth organizations, to speak up for the agreement and speak out against misinformation.
But he doesn't define misinformation. What is he talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, Jody, we don't know exactly because the terms are vague. And I think it at times they might be deliberately left vague in order to allow for maneuvering room by those who wish to use these terms and definitions at some point. Certainly this topic has, the topic of misinformation, the idea of misinformation has been tossed around a lot. It's been in some of the drafts of the pandemic agreement. Now it still was left in the preamble of one of the drafts more recently. It only breeds more public distrust when people are not able to fully share their concerns and air their grievances. And the people of the world need to be heard. And the people of the United States need to be heard in terms of their concerns about the WHO, about the way the COVID-19 pandemic was handled, about the way any of their health information might be distributed or shared or given over to some government program that they're unaware of. So, number one, people's voices need to be heard. They need to be listened to. Number two, the governments of the world who want to agree to this really need to do a better job of explaining it to their people and to be saying, look, here's what we'd like to do and here's why we'd like to do it. People still might disagree, but at least then things would be more in the light than they are now. Part of the problem with what we have right now here, the current status of this agreement, is the way it is appeared to be have been done in the darkness. So I think at a minimum, we need to air things out, put them in the light. And that's also a telling sign if people don't want to do that. If governments don't want to do it and leaders don't want to do it, what are they hiding? It should be no brainer to air out and explain to your own citizens what you are looking to do by entering into a pandemic preparedness agreement and what you are willing to do as a government, of national government, in entering into amendments to the international health regulations. You cannot explain what and why you want to make those changes. You need to stop right there and really ask why there's an inability to explain. I think also, if we do that, it's going to go a long way to at least solving some of the problem here. People still might disagree, but at least then things would be out in the open. Part of this misinformation crackdown, to put it that way, is it's an attempt to suppress the conversation instead of having the conversation and then saying, look, we've had one, we may disagree, but at least we've had the conversation. We can't be suppressing those conversations. It's only going to breed more distrust, breed more fracturing, and breed more disunity. And I think part of the way ahead on some of these issues is to have more of those conversations.
Sounds very similar to what some things that we're experiencing here in the United States. So the claims of misinformation coming, basically referring to and meaning anything that disagrees with us, us being those who are in charge. But there's no wonder that they've failed to get consensus when they put all, so much of this together in the dark behind closed doors and then just springing on everyone. But given that the failure to build the consensus, what are you hearing, Travis, from the participants that you're speaking with? And what do you anticipate going forward? I know you said that there's a lot of different options, but what are you hearing and what do you anticipate is going to be the outcome this week?
Yeah. So, Jody, as I was observing the plenary sessions in the main room in which the delegates, there were two delegates representing each member state in a circular formation around this room, in which the president, the presiding officer of the World Health Assembly, the director general, and other leaders are up front. That's a room in which the nations who are member states of the WHO come together and share their remarks, their perspectives with the general body of the World Health Assembly as it's coming together to discuss a number of topics, right? So you have there were a lot of short speeches, a number of different topics. Certainly some themes emerged there. We could go into some of those, explore some of those, but it was actually quite eye-opening to see how some of these themes were emerging. It would not be automatically, necessarily understandable why they are emerging at the World Health Organization. Themes like a targeting and focus on condemning Israel for its activity in the Gaza Strip. Some nations would make an attempt to link that to healthcare. Some didn't even try to do that. And they're just standing there making speeches about Israel. And this is the World Health Organization, World Health Assembly. In theory, they're supposed to be coming together to try to solve health concerns, but you see a kind of world table of power players, each looking to push their perspective, advance their perspective by making speeches. So that struck me as quite odd, honestly, being in that room and hearing the speeches of member states. I think, Jody, to get to your question about kind of where are we going, what's the sense of states, you've got a number of member states here who are small, poor states, and understandably, they want and in some ways may need the help of more well-off, advanced countries in solving health crises in their countries. So some of these things are not new. Issues like malaria in Africa, and other diseases for which there have been vaccines developed, routine healthcare issues that are plaguing populations of some of these countries. We have to understand this discussion and this meeting in that context, because these issues have been going on for a long time. Despite the more recent emergence of the COVID pandemic, the response to COVID, the concerns and issues around that, and now the subsequent attempt to amend the health regulations, which had been around before COVID, and institute a new agreement or treaty dealing with pandemics post-COVID, right? So in that context, we have to look at those concerns and understand that many nations are trying to look out for the interests of their citizens in some way. The question is whether whatever solutions are arrived at will actually help those citizens with better health outcomes and with solving, in some cases, issues that are life-threatening. The other thing to keep in mind is that some of these nations come from a very different governance perspective than the United States. United States, there's a tradition of government from distribution to individuals, to families, to local communities. And only in bigger issues, in theory, is the federal government supposed to get involved, certainly constitutionally. There are areas enumerated to the federal government under our Constitution. And if they're not there, the issue in theory should be left to the states. And we have a philosophy of government going back to our founding, which depends on a self-governing moral and religious people. So this really sets the stage for people in the United States to say, why should the federal government be tackling XYZ issue in the first place? A lot of these countries may come from a different, and they do come from a different governance perspective. And in the United States, healthcare is a matter left to the states under the Constitution. And in other countries, they might have a culture or a governance system, a legal structure that says the federal government it's normal to look to the federal government and the central government to deal with these concerns and these problems. So you really see that emerging, where these world leaders show up at a meeting like this and they come around the table and they say, how can we solve the problems of our citizens? And I look at that and think, well, it's holed up, because in the United States, we don't necessarily think that way. That's just important to understand as we look at a conversation like this, because the conversation will be happening. The nations of the world have and will always find a way to come together. The question is not that. The question is whether the mechanism and the way in which they're coming together, in this case, the World Health Organization and the Assembly, and a specific mechanism like the pandemic agreement, is the necessary, proper, and right approach for them to come together. Certainly, that's under dispute at a minimum. And I think there are a number of concerns about that a number of nations share. And so I think, we're going to see continued discussion over whether and how resources shall be distributed or shared between countries. Some of the African states are objecting to the language that is somewhere attempting to put into these agreements about sexual right. reproductive rights and the inclusion of these ideology that go against their cultural values and could be interpreted to be part of any such agreement when terms are interpreted.
We're going to have to wrap it up there, Travis.
They're objecting to that.
Travis Weber, policy editor for Washington Stand and vice president for policy and government affairs here at FRC. For more info to stay in touch of what Travis is finding, washingtonstand.org/who. He'll be back with us tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch. We'll see you tomorrow right here.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.